Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in Four Ways in Johannesburg today for the first in a series of promoted podcasts with CECOM, which I'm really looking forward to. In fact, over the course of 2019, we'll be bringing you 10 interviews with CECOM executives, exploring every aspect of the business, including its history, its strategic direction, and what the future holds. So I'm very pleased to welcome Byron Clutterbuck, CECOM's CEO, to set the scene in this first interview in the series. It's great to see you again, Byron. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So this first podcast is really meant as a scene setter, and we're going to be exploring some of the fascinating background that led to CECOM and how the business has changed over the years. But before we get to all that, Byron, please tell me a bit about yourself. What did you do before joining the CECOM team, and how did you end up joining the company?
Well, I'll go back a little further than that, actually, and start off with, you probably noticed that I have an American accent.
Yep.
So I did grow up in the United States in Washington, D.C. We consider that to be quite a neutral American accent, but I realize for our listeners here, it might sound a bit strong. I left the United States when I was 22 years old with a history degree.
You still have the accent.
I do have the accent. You don't lose the accent, really. And I moved to Taiwan to study Mandarin Chinese when I was 22. So I went with a backpack and kind of left and decided to go on an adventure and see what that would hold for me. Ended up staying there for 3 years, then moved to Hong Kong, was working and traveling all over China. I guess through different business areas, ended up working for a company called Texas Instruments, which was kind of in the technology space, and investing into China. And at that time, the CEO of Texas Instruments had become the CEO of BT, British Telecom. So I got kind of approached, would I be interested in helping BT, a telecommunications company, look at opportunities into China and in Asia. So I ended up joining the telecommunications industry in 1997 with kind of that China business background, but no real experience in telecommunications. And then various corporations kind of building what was really the advent of data networks, I would say. I mean, back at 97, of course, it was still about phone calls, voice minutes. SMS was, you know, maybe the new hot thing. Mm-hmm. But really using smartphones was not. That they didn't really come out probably until the iPhone 10 years later. So, you know, data networks, though, were important for corporations at the time. And we had some old technologies that are still around, some of them today, in various markets. So I started building up data networks in Asia. Joined a company, Level 3, which again very much focused on the data wave in the United States, but also expanded internationally at that time. Then that was sold to a company called Reach, and then I left from Reach to join a company that was then called VSNL International, which became Tata Communications. Mm. And at that time, Tata was acquiring a lot of data networks and subsea cable infrastructure after the dot-com crash in kind of 99-2000. And kind of leapfrogged onto that in 2004, 2005. And actually, that's how I got introduced to CECOM, because actually at that time, Tata was interested in building a cable from India into Europe, and also had an investment in Neotel here in South Africa. So we're interested also in connecting India into South Africa. So the people at CECOM and the people in my team, we worked together to actually kind of create what became the CECOM cable system. And then I left Tata and joined CECOM about six and a half years ago, and have been working in Africa since then, about mid-2012.
So CECOM was really the brainchild of the founder and former CEO, Brian Herlihy. He saw there was a need for a submarine cable running up Africa's east coast. You've given us some hints about how the project got its start, but what was the real genesis of this? How did it really happen?
Now, I think, you know, when you looked around the world and you looked at all the developments that were happening everywhere else with connectivity and data connectivity in particular, and, you know, new cables getting built all through Asia into South America, between Europe and the United States, all over Europe, et cetera, both terrestrial and subsea. And Africa was literally the dark continent. There was one cable system. It was the SAT-3 cable system. It went RFS in 2002. It was very low data speeds by today's standards, even then. It was low data speeds, and it was kind of a monopoly cable. So there was no open access to that cable, despite the fact that really the monopoly incumbent, funded by the government, funded by the taxpayer, built that cable. You really couldn't get access to the data speeds there. So all the people who were trying to provide ISP services or data services in South Africa, despite the fact that the cable was there, couldn't use it. So Brian Herlihy had been working and looking very interested in Africa. He's more of an entrepreneur, was looking for various projects, knew a bit about the telecommunications industry, and had a couple of projects on the go that were to bring a ring of fiber around Africa. That was the original project. But, you know, as you try to get landings and you're trying to get investors and you're trying to find out where the markets are, and that somewhat related a little bit with Tata, you know, the Seacom cable project came into being. So, okay, where was the initial focus? Let's try South Africa to Europe via Egypt. We can build it jointly with Tata and work on some of the investment costs by sharing some of the infrastructure along the way. And really, that's how it came to be. And I think once you had the concept idea, then it became, okay, where are the markets that you want to land in? And I think that was quite critical. And South Africa was a leading proponent of saying, hey, we will allow a new open access cable to land. And I mean, if you think about it, even today, a lot of the cables getting landed around the world, you know, the idea that you could not be an incumbent player, not have all of the licensing, you could have private funding and actually land a cable that you will sell to everyone and anyone. And the benefits now that we understand what that does to an economy, really it ended up just being South Africa, Mozambique, Tanzania, Kenya, and then into India and across Egypt. So a lot of countries actually that could have landed, but because of the difficulty or the government's position on that, the cable did not land there. And I think if you see the economies and the development of infrastructure and the internet, what's happened, it's really been the countries that have allowed those cables to land that have really developed much quicker.
I think a lot of people forget how bad the internet was in South Africa just 10 or 15 years ago before Seacom arrived, when Sat3 was the only game in town. ADSL into people's homes was heavily capped. Seacom arrived on the scene. It allowed ISPs, I think MWeb was the first, but others quickly followed, to offer uncapped home services, and it really transformed the home internet market, but it also had a big impact on the business space as well. The model that Seacom brought to market is very different to anything we'd seen in this territory before. As you mentioned, it was consortiums, telco, big incumbent telcos that were responsible historically for building these cables. You brought a very different business model. Just maybe talk us through that business model and how it managed to change internet access in South Africa and other countries in the region.
Yeah, it is quite a unique model. It's not a unique model for Africa. It's actually a globally unique model. Mm-hmm. There are not many cable systems that get built today or in the past 20 years that are fully private cable systems. In other words, that private investors invest in a project and they're not telecommunications companies, and they build infrastructure so that other telecommunications companies can use that infrastructure. You know, it's quite, you know, the advent of data centers now is becoming that. It used to be data centers were all built by telecommunications companies and they were kind of their own personal fiefdoms. And now you have actually very large global companies that build data centers. So similar in that vein, that private money said, hey, there is carrier neutral infrastructure that should be available for everyone to use in an open access manner. So I think that was kind of a, you know, groundbreaking structure. And of course, then you need to find investors. And I think in that regard, also, the investors that created Seacom in 2007, 2008 and put in all the money, none of them were telecommunications companies. They were all private investors, or some of our shareholders like Remgro, Convergence Partners, Sanlam, infrastructure projects up in Kenya, part of the Aga Khan Group. They had done power plants and other infrastructure projects, but nothing in the telecommunications space, certainly nothing of this magnitude. And then,
was,
of course,
was that a risk? Was that a risk?
Yeah, of course, it was a very big risk. I think, you know, de-risking it, one step was to work with Tata, because that de-risked some of the costs of some of the build, particularly up into Egypt and across Egypt and into to Europe. And then you had to find anchor tenant customers. So customers who, as you say, the internet connectivity costs in South Africa at that time, and a lot of it, you know, if you could get Sat3 connectivity, you were paying, you know, probably $15,000 a month for an E1 or something. And I think that the price for satellite was even above $3,000 to $4,000 US dollars, right? So that's a magnitude per make. Mm-hmm. So the idea, you know, where we're at now, where you're paying less than $5 a meg, right? And again, we want it cheaper. But still, I think that the business case that had to be built was a big challenge, because these are private investors. These are investors who wanted to see a return on their investment. And so getting the investors on board and building that business case. So you had to look at, okay, what markets? and what customers are you going to sell to, and how quickly can you sell, and how quickly can you get that capacity activated. So actually, and the other unique feature of Seacom, I think it was built very quickly. Mm-hmm. And we had some delays across Egypt in the construction, and we had to route traffic in a certain way. But it was actually a very quickly built system for what it was. And really, it was a race at that time because there were a few other projects underway. Easy, which is a consortium mm-hmm. cable. And then up in Kenya, up to Fujairah, another cable called Teams. All yeah. came online around late 2009. We were in a bit earlier in July 2009. They came in a bit later that year and also in early 2010. So you had really no cables from 2002 until 2009. Mm. Pretty amazing, given the demand that would be here, the size of the markets, everything else, and the lack of connectivity. It took 7 years to really get the first cable in, and then when it came, two more came right after it.
Yeah, interesting. So what is the lifespan of these cables? Does Seacom have to, are you going to build another cable at some point? When the current
Generally speaking, your suppliers, and there's a limited number of suppliers who build specialized subsea cables because it's actually quite an intricate construction project, the cable, the physical infrastructure itself, right? There's, of course, the landing stations, which are obviously usually on the coast that house all the electronics and must be like mini data centers. And then you have the electronics, of course, that you may change. Mm-hmm. But the underlying infrastructure, once it gets out in the ocean, once you put it down there, you hope it's going to stay there. And the usually guaranteed life of those cable systems is 25 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Seacom's been in the ocean for what, 12 years?
Been about 9 years.
9 years.
Yeah. So when you look at it that way, we've still got some room to go. But, you know, technology advances very quickly. So what happens is we design a certain fiber spec and we place our repeaters. These are amplification devices that take our light beams that go down the fiber and they rebroadcast them, if you will. And really, the spacing of those repeaters and the quality of the fiber and where you have your power to power those things up all contribute to how much capacity you can send down that fiber pair.
So every so often you'd upgrade that.
Yeah. So we change out the electronics, and we used to use, just on the spacing on that fiber, we used to use 10 gig. So the original system was designed to have 10 gig packets, if you will, with 64 of them. In other words, 64 lambdas on each fiber pair. So we could get up to 640 gigabits. Mm-hmm. That was the original design on two fiber pairs, 1.28 terabytes. We now believe we can get about 6 terabytes, maybe a bit more than that. Certain segments, we can probably get over 12 terabytes per fiber pair.
Wow.
That is just due to going from 10 gig. We then tried out some 40 gig packs. We now ride, everything is 100 gig. Mm-hmm. We made some announcements probably about 2 years ago that we swapped everything out using 100 gig packs, which is more efficient when you're broadcasting data. It's obviously more cost efficient, and we can get more capacity out of that fiber.
Yeah, so and that technology roadmap will continue. You'll go to 400G and beyond eventually.
Yeah, we believe so, although there are some physical limitations just because of the way the systems are designed originally. Yeah. You can push it, but how far you can push it is a question. And a lot of that is dependent on the physical infrastructure. We have seen some cable systems be taken up and repeaters replaced with new technology that can do that. That's quite expensive.
Yeah.
So the question would be, is that an option or would you build another cable? Now that we're, and I think the plan would be, first off, we're a cable on the East Coast, Seacom. We realized some time ago, and this is the kind of the story of our evolution, that that was day one, boom, bring capacity into the market, sell it to the big ISPs, the mobile network operators, the carriers, so that they could then take it to market. And I think once you kind of saturated that market, so to speak, people who are building data networks, the one thing you need, obviously, is a low-cost, reliable transmission solution, but you also need resiliency. You cannot rely on one pipe. You cannot put all your eggs in one basket, as we'd say, right? So the WAX cable system, which came in 2012, and we ended up investing in that, a little backdoor investment, to get capacity on the WAX cable system, gave us the ability to protect our network. Okay, ideally, you'd like to have 3-4 paths so that you can mesh. Okay, this is the new design of data networks is use them all fully, but mesh with adequate separation on as many paths as you can afford.
Yeah.
So WAX gave us that ability, and that kind of changed the game into what we did as well.
So full redundancy right around the African continent.
Exactly. So I think we won some awards back when we launched that product, which was the ring around Africa. Mm-hmm. So, if you wanted to order a circuit that was going from London to Johannesburg, we would offer you, if your work path was on the East Coast and it went down for any reason, you'd be switched over to the West Coast. So you wouldn't actually see much of an impact on your network.
Yeah. I remember in the early days of CECOM, of course, all the ISPs signed up with CECOM because of the massive cost advantages relative to the capacity on the West Coast. And I remember in those early days, there were when CECOM had some challenges, like a fiber break somewhere in the Middle East, for example. It was the internet in South Africa, if you're a home user, particularly slowed to a crawl. That's been resolved now with the arrival of WAX and redundant routes and all that sort of thing. But there was a time when, if CECOM went down.
Yeah, there was a time when the internet went down. CECOM went down, the internet's down.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you're kind of amazed that, hey, we weren't here that long ago, and now all of a sudden you guys are 100% relying on this. But that's really what happened. I mean, if you think about the cost advantages, right, and the fact that, obviously, the other cable is also a linear single-path cable, right? So you could balance your network, but you could buy 10 times as much capacity on CECOM. Mm. So if CECOM went down, everyone was flooding CECOM with their traffic, so it really couldn't switch over to SAT-3 because the contention, you know, the variance and how much capacity you could pump through SAT-3 was limited.
There
were many years until WAX came that it was, you know, if there was a problem with the internet, the finger pointed at us all the time.
Before we move on, I'm really fascinated by these submarine cable projects. I mean, they're massive projects. There must be an incredible amount of project management work involved in bringing them to fruition, because you're working with potential funders, you're looking for funding, you're working with contractor submarine cable deployment companies, you've got to do marine surveys, you're working with governments and regulators, which can, I'm sure, is never easy. Just maybe take us through what is involved in running one of these systems. I mean, you must have had particular challenges deploying a marine cable through the Red Sea, which is known for a lot of fiber breaks. There's certain politics in that region that must make it more difficult to deploy fiber infrastructure. What is it like to project manage something of this scale? What does it involve? What does it take?
Yeah, I've never really been a project manager for the actual construction, but I generally the commercial driver or the lead person who's built the business case, brings in the investors, brings in the partners, and gets it done. My colleague Klaus Siegelberg, who I believe will be on your podcast, I hope, can give you the specifics, because it gets pretty hands-on and difficult when you actually realize some of the things that can go on. And I'll give you some anecdotal stories, but maybe he can elaborate a bit more. But I think, you know, first and foremost, as you say, it's like, you know, you look for where is the market, right? Because I think you're never going to get the investors unless you have the idea that there is a demand, there is a market, and it is underserved or it is non-served. And we have a project that we think can meet the market requirements. And I think CECOM was very much that. I think the countries that were then chosen because they had adequate market size, but they also then said, okay, well, can you actually land and get into that market? Because if you can't, well, there's no point. So there's a lot of markets, you know, at that time, Madagascar or Somalia or Eritrea, there's no point even to look because you're not ever going to get a landing permit, right? So there might be a market, but sorry, it's off limits, right? So you kind of have to pick your markets based on, you know, size of the market, the money that you'd see return, and the ability to get a license, right? And that license might be an operating license to land the cable, but then you have environmental impacts. You have other cables you have to cross. You might have pipelines you have to deal with. You might have security issues and concerns. So once you've kind of got the concept and the design, we usually do, and the investors will go to get a desktop survey done. So these are companies that generally help you construct, and then lay the cable for you. They have to kind of say, okay, there's a massive ridge under the ocean here that drops off. So there, if you're going to build the cable, you want to route it around that ridge. You want to avoid maybe this earthquake zone. You want to avoid these pipelines. So you kind of get an idea where you could route the cable, where it's going to work, and could be laid and would be secure as it could be. And so once that's done, you kind of agree that that's the survey, then you have to go get some of those permits, right? Because you have to say, hey, here's my project, here's what I'm going to do, here's where I'm going to do it, right? And governments are quite usually concerned about this, right? They want to know, what are you going to do to my beach? What's going to happen? Is this going to, you know, disrupt fishing? Is it going to disrupt anything else, right? And these are all concerns that usually get addressed. But once the cable is down there, it's usually pretty stable, and I think the most governments around the world realize it's a pretty benign thing under the ocean. Then you have to select your provider who's going to build it for you, right? And you usually look for a company that has some experience in the oceans you're working in with the landing sites. Unfortunately, this was the first cable. up the east coast of Africa.
So there, right? there were no surveys.
So there was really nobody who said, yeah, I've built a few cables there. You know, people had done surveys before, people had looked at it, but really no one had built a cable. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get to the Red Sea, as you state, everything going from Asia into Europe goes through the Red Sea, you know, around the Horn there and through the Red Sea. And the Red Sea is quite narrow. And you have pipelines, and you have jurisdictional waters between, you know, Saudi Arabia, Eritrea, Djibouti, Iran, you name it, Egypt, as you get closer. So that is always a concern, because it's not only about where you lay the cable. It's like, what happens if it breaks? What happens if a trawler drags it up and breaks the cable?
Which is very likely in that area,
which
because
actually
it's
does happen. As you mentioned, those earlier outages were actually mostly anchor drags.
Right.
So we will actually notify the authorities. They'll mark our cable on a chart. That chart is then distributed to all the fishing boats, the tankers, anything that would be. That is a no anchor zone. But a storm comes. Captain of a ship throws his anchor over, drags up a cable. It happens, right? And usually we'll break our cable. We then have to go send a ship in to fix it. So to get that ship in to territorial waters of another country, you also need permits, right? And you might need visas for the people on that ship to get into the territorial waters of that country. So all these things take time. And so when people, the internet's down, fix it. And you're like, well, guys, the ship can only move so fast. It's got to get there. It's got to find the break, lift the cable up, weld the fiber back together, seal it all up, wrap it all up. And we got to relight everything and retune the amplifiers. So, you know, it's not as easy as you'd like it to be. But hopefully it doesn't go down too often.
Yeah.
And we've been lucky since then that we've been pretty stable.
Yeah.
And there have been improvements with certain technology we use to send out a beacon, and we can actually track ships that get close to our cable, and vice versa. Ships can know where the cables are so that they avoid them. Mm-hmm. And we actually have had pursued some cases where ships that have broken a cable, we've gone after them, or various organizations and governments have gone after them and say, you need to pay reparations. Because if that doesn't happen, the ship's captain doesn't care.
Yeah.
Right? But he realizes, hey, Captain X over here just got fined $1 million. He's going to think about it.
Do you see that money, or does it go to some regular?
No, we don't see that money, but we might see a portion of that money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Generally speaking, a lot of those cables get broken, and there might be two or three cables dragged up at the same time.
Because especially in that region.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's either in the Med or in the Red Sea.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so Seacom today is quite a different business to the one it was when you launched the submarine cable. You're no longer simply a supplier of undersea bandwidth. In fact, the company has morphed into a broader supplier of ICT solutions. And, of course, you've launched Seacom Business a couple of years ago. Take us through some of the timeline of events and why the business needed to change.
Yeah, well, as we kind of discussed earlier, I think the first phase was really bringing water to a desert with people dying of thirst. And really, Seacom came, and we managed to provide capacity to all the big ISPs, mobile network operators, et cetera, for them to plug into their networks and to start offering something to their customers. Now, once we had sold that infrastructure and capacity to them, you know, those sales started to slow down because they had adequate capacity, and you had to actually disperse that capacity into the marketplace. And we realized, and it was WACS in 2012 that said, hey, now we can have a resilient network. So there's a new part of the market that we can sell to. And this is actually when I came into Seacom. And we said, let's build up our IP transit service. So if you're a smaller ISP, and the proliferation of smaller ISPs in Southern and East Africa, you don't have to invest and buy Seacom capacity and WAX capacity and build your own network and put a POP in London and manage your upstream IP transit providers and all this kind of stuff, because you're really probably your scale is not large enough to afford that. So we said, look, why not instead you plug into our IPT backbone, you buy IP transit from us, and we will connect you to all the content that you need to run your business. Right? So really that was the first step, I would say, in becoming, going away from an infrastructure provider to becoming a service provider. And I think that was a step that, and the obvious logical next step after you become a service provider is to provide to corporates. Because I think in today's age, there's not much of a difference between an ISP's requirements on their data network and a bank's or a media company's, right? So it was kind of progression to go, first, let's build up a resilient network with as many paths as we can operate on, and build up as much content as we can connect to. So content is actually quite critical, whether that is storage or content that people want to look on a social media platform, or whether it is work-related. Now, we decided we're going to focus on corporates. So as you're right, about 3.5 years ago in South Africa, we launched what we call Seacom Business. And really the idea was to take our capabilities and our service platform and our service providing skills and deliver that into the corporate space. And I think really our focus was looking for corporates who really wanted more data connectivity. So there's certain kinds of industries you'd say lend themselves naturally, banking, of course, with massive platforms, or certain kinds of businesses in media or content distribution. Those were our first kind of customers. But we've since kind of just said, okay, as we roll out more and more terrestrial network in South Africa, and we put out more metro nodes, we will deploy further and further into the marketplace. But we are largely focused on corporates and enterprise customers, we would say.
And how's that business?
Yeah, it's our fastest growing business, obviously. We expect that in another year's time, it'll be half of our revenue. So it's gone from 0% to close to 35-40% today. So certainly, I think really the reality is that in the, what we used to call the wholesale space, but that service provider space, there's a lot more choices and more cables will get built. So our CECOM connectivity that was new and fresh in the day has become just one of many paths today. And there are a lot of owners in Easy, a lot of owners in WAX, and there's new cables being built, which we can talk about shortly. So we've kind of had to somewhat, you know, from our perspective, would be almost de-risk our business, at the same time look for opportunities to grow our business. And I think when you look at the size, if you just step back and looked at South Africa, the size of the wholesale business for data, it would probably be less than 10% of the corporate spend on data connectivity. So, you know, you can chase that small market and dominate it, but you're unlikely to fully dominate it just because there are other options available for customers. So we thought, let's get a small market share in the corporate enterprise space. Mm-hmm. And that's a growing space. And certainly, you know, what we're seeing now is the advent of more cloud computing, which we obviously, even at that time, knew was coming. But I think all those applications, you know, and the virtual compute power, even that now we can see coming to South Africa, largely as a result of the things that we did over the past few years to bring up data connectivity, to bring up adequate resiliency in the networks. And obviously that follows on that terrestrial networks also need to be resilient and available at the right cost, and data centers. So you bring all those things together, all of a sudden you have a much more healthy ecosystem that says, okay, the cloud players, the cloud compute players, the storage players, the apps, they can all be local, whether it's Netflix for your consumer or it's Facebook, or if it's a business application over Microsoft or Amazon, et cetera.
They all build on top of each other as each component comes to
market. Yeah, kind of gains momentum, and you start saying, okay, you know, all of that, and I think it's happening globally. We talk about, you know, the extension of that compute power to be closer to the customer. Mm. Because if you're going to convince someone to say, okay, move your servers and your compute power from your office to a data center, you're going to need to have that close by.
Yeah.
Right? You can't say, I'm going to move that from my office to London. And that's probably not going to work for you, right?
Yeah.
So I think what's happening globally, and what's certainly happening also in Africa, is that you're seeing first the data centers come to the major metropolitan areas, and then smaller data centers get closer to where actually the compute power is required. So you'll see data centers in Sandton to support, you know, and you might have to see redundant data centers. There might be smaller ones that you've not heard of, but they are there. And this is true in all of the content as well as the virtual kind of cloud computing area.
Out of interest, does the data center business interest CECOM at all?
I think data centers, in my opinion, have always been a great business if you are a completely carrier-neutral provider of those data centers. And then the second thing is that you need, I think in today's business, like you need a global platform. So it'll be interesting to see how Equinix and some of the larger players, Interxion, as they build out their global platforms, right? Because what happens is global multinationals say, I want to be able to connect all my sites, and if I want to put things in various data centers, I want to know there's consistency in the security and the connectivity that I can get and the cross-connect procedures. Most of these things being done online today. So I think while in South Africa and in Africa, you don't have that many carrier-neutral data centers, for one. And two, they are not part of that global network, if you will, a global platform. But I think that will change. We've always offered data centers as part of our connectivity offering. So all of our cable stations are really small data centers where backhaul providers or customers can put equipment in to get access to our connectivity. But we're a connectivity provider. Mm. And I think there's quite a bit of a difference between a connectivity provider and a data center provider. Mm. So our view is we'll leave the data centers to the data center experts and those global platforms, and we'll focus on connecting those data centers.
Just coming back to Secom Business, your focus has been exclusively on South Africa, is that right, for now?
About 2 years ago, we launched in Kenya.
Okay.
So again, you know, that kind of business case process, we looked and we said, okay, where are the markets that are open, growing? You know, you can't just look at GDP growth because that could be skewed by, you know, oil exports. So we look at really where are the corporations, where are people investing, where's the foreign direct investment coming, and where are the economies kind of growing in a healthy way from a business perspective. So when we looked at those markets, we kind of picked South Africa first and foremost, and then we picked Kenya as the second market. Mm-hmm. So we're actually growing very well in Kenya. It's a smaller market. Economy is quite a bit smaller than South Africa, but it's a good market for us. It's quite concentrated. We would, when we say markets, we actually really look at metropolitan centers.
Right.
So, you know, when we look at South Africa, we're thinking more Gauteng, Cape Town, Durban, and then we'll start to look at some tier two cities. We can talk about that with our planned acquisition of Fibreco, which will give us the ability to kind of pop more tier two cities in South Africa. Same in if you look in East Africa, we kind of look at Mombasa, Nairobi, Kampala. You know, and those, if you said, we don't go to the countryside in Kenya. We focus where are the businesses? Where do businesses need connectivity and data connectivity in particular?
Well, I think it's a neat segue. Let's talk a bit about the Fibreco acquisition. Announced a couple of months ago now, I think. What's the rationale behind that? I mean, and Secom has been quite an acquisitive business. It's bought a number of companies over.
Yeah, we have. And the companies we've acquired predominantly have had a few things that we want to grow. And that really is getting more customers and getting more metro networks that support those customers. So as we layered on that enterprise business, we kind of did start it with a do-it-yourself attitude, and we went after customers directly ourselves. But then we realized that there are some smaller ISPs that had the same kind of thinking as us that really didn't have the scale, but that actually if we kind of connected to them and enabled them to have the international capabilities and the content and virtual cloud compute capability connectivity that we have, they could build a more successful business. So we started with a small acquisition of some assets in a little company called Photon that had just 14 buildings on net. We then acquired a company called Macroland that was really Western Cape, and then SAI in Durban. So really, if you think about it, that kind of just gives us a presence, an office, the people, the teams, and the network and the footprint and customers that can kind of kickstart our business. Very easy to plug those networks into the Secom infrastructure and allow them to sell that and deliver the service to more and more customers. So that was the first step, and we're continuing to look at those kind of acquisitions. But Fibreco was on the market, and I think the other element to our business is that east-west connectivity is becoming more and more important, and there are new cables coming into South Africa, both on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and it's critical that we create a ring around Africa. And we believe that Fibreco, with its fiber capabilities from the East Coast of South Africa to the West Coast of South Africa, as well as down into some other towns and into East London, we thought that actually that fiber infrastructure, if we could take it, light it, and deliver it, then we could provide a service both to kind of protect East and Southern Africa, but also to drive deeper into the market in South Africa by popping cities along the way. So, you know, we can then start to look at, we've targeted about four or five, you know, tier two cities that actually, when you look at them, they may look small in the South African context, but when you compare them to cities in Namibia or Botswana or, you know, Zambia, they actually look pretty big. So when you look at the economy and how many businesses and the infrastructure that they're, those are more attractive metropolitan centers than maybe other countries would represent. So yeah, that's our plan, both to use that as an east-west connectivity at a fiber level and then to light that fiber and then also to be able to pop more cities in South Africa and deliver our services into more cities.
So is that deal just awaiting regulatory clearances now?
It is under the Competition Commission, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we hope we'll hear in a couple of weeks on that one.
Right.
So that should be something we're expecting in first quarter this year.
That's interesting what you say about the east-west connectivity. There's been talk over the years about possibly building a cable system, submarine cable system, to link KZN, the Umthunzini site, to the landing stations north of Cape Town. I think CECOM has looked at that as well as a possibility in the past. Is there something about that route that no one is deploying it? Does it make more sense to deploy the fiber terrestrially rather than under the ocean?
Well, I think you would think terrestrial fiber because, again, you can stop along the way.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, right? But terrestrial fiber is quite expensive, and you know the lots of parts of South Africa are pretty rugged,
yeah.
isolated terrain where you've got to construct and maintain. So you don't have to just build it and leave it there. You actually have to maintain it, and you have to power it. Mm. So you know, a subsea route, I think, is a good idea. I think it will happen, but I don't think at the time we looked at it. It wasn't a great business case as a standalone proposition. In other words, getting the ships down just to build that small segment between mm-hmm. Cape Town and Durban really didn't make much sense. But I think when you look at the new cables that are coming, the cable on the East Coast, their view is they'll come down, they'll land in Durban, but they'll also build around to Cape Town. The cable on the West Coast will come down, land in Cape Town, but also wants to build around to Durban. Whether both of those happen, I don't know. Mm. But I think certainly there is a value add of having a wet route, so to speak, that you could use as kind of a festoon system that could land into other cities along the coast, which could be challenging because those are difficult landings, I think. But it's very deep water, mm-hmm. so it's very secure, and you can get incredible throughput, a very low power consumption on those routes. Mm-hmm. So when you think about it, you know, getting Cape Town to Durban, you'd have a very reliable, low-cost route that is diverse from everything else. And is not, you know, you're probably not going to be worrying about power cuts or backhoes digging it up or you know things like that or equipment failures and remote access. So you know it's a subsea cable; it's in the water. Sure, if it breaks, you've got to go down there and dig it up and fix it. But it's unlikely in those deep waters. So we see it as a very secure route and a good viable option. Again, if it's built as part of those East and West Coast builds, that also brings the cost down.
Mm. Might CECOM participate in some of those builds?
Yeah, our plan is actually, you know, as we change what we were to what we are becoming, I think for us, network quality is absolutely critical. And really, network quality can only be obtained if you have enough resiliency in your network. So, you know, the CECOM cable is still our key anchor asset, but we are planning to participate in really both the new cables that would get built on East and West Coast. So that's really for our future. And we see, you know, the growth of data requirements for businesses to continue to grow, right? And all that compute power, all those cloud players that are coming into Africa, and really South Africa is their first stop. So we think we help enable them already, and we'd like to continue to do so. So we kind of need to continue to develop a resilient network that has more capacity. And eventually, as you know, CECOM is almost 10 years old, so we've got to be thinking of the future, and it has a limited amount of capacity. The new cables that come out today, each fiber pair could easily be 12 to maybe 14, 16 terabytes. So that by having that high capability, you bring down the unit cost.
Byron, this has been a fascinating discussion. Before I let you go, maybe if you don't mind, just paint a picture of where you see CECOM going over the next, say, 3 to 5 years. Are you going to make more acquisitions? You're clearly interested in investing in more infrastructure. Do you see opportunities to make more acquisitions in South Africa and the rest of the region? And how do you see CECOM's role in the telecommunications landscape evolving in as we go forward?
Yeah, I think going forward, you certainly, if you look around the globe, I think there's no question that there is continued consolidation in our industry, mm-hmm. right? And I think that is just because it's highly capital intensive, you know, and scale is therefore very important. And I think quality of network or quality of service delivery is very important. So I think therefore you see companies who, you know, they want to own the infrastructure so they can manage it end to end. And that's quite important for CECOM as well. I think we like to deliver on fiber to our customers predominantly because we like to put our own equipment at the end so we can actually manage it. Even though we may not own or operate the fiber, we operate the connectivity that's delivered over that fiber. So that's quite important to us, and I think it's important in the industry at large. I think you know, people want to be able to control the quality of their networks at the lowest possible cost. So I think we would say that we would be continuing to acquire companies, companies of a like mind of ours that are focused on data connectivity, focused on the quality of service and managing that service for customers. So I think, yes, we'll both be looking at terrestrial you know, long haul, which is kind of FiberCo. We'll be looking at more companies that have metro fiber as well as customers. But I do think that while there are other markets that we're interested in and are attractive, we believe that given our size and where we are today, that we'll focus on the company, on the countries, excuse me, the markets where we have our infrastructure in place and we have a license and we have the people and the teams in place. And really, that's why we started with South Africa and Kenya. And if you look logically, Uganda, actually we connect there into with fiber into Uganda. That's another market that we're going to be expanding into this year. We've looked at Tanzania and Mozambique, and I think those would be on the cards. It's really a matter of how big the business opportunity is there. What's the competitive landscape? Should we go beyond our service provider role in those markets and drive deeper into the corporate space? And that remains to be seen. I don't really see us, you know, you never know. There are acquisition opportunities that could say, hey, we're going to look at West Africa or we're going to look at North Africa. But I think, you know, for the next 2 to 3 years, we certainly see there's enough opportunity in the markets that we're in to grow and to penetrate and provide our service, you know, kind of differentiate with our service and our quality and our network into the markets of South Africa and Kenya and potentially some ancillary markets.
Byron Clatterbuck is CEO of Seacom. Thank you so much for talking to Tech Central today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.